You are listening to an exclusive podcast on Money Control.
Hello and welcome to Decoding 2019, where we discuss all things elections in the run-up to the greatest spectacle of democracy, the Indian elections. Today, we're going to be talking about social media, messaging platforms, and politics. How they're intertwined, and how sometimes they can be a hellish match made in heaven. In the early decades of its inception, the state-run media platform, the only one existing back then, Doordarshan, dispensed, if not slanted, then subtly sanitized news. However, the news streaming scenario has experienced a dramatic upheaval in the recent years, not just in India, but the world over. As a piece on ThoughtCo pointed out in January 2019, and as writer Tom Merce said, the use of social media, including Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube in politics has dramatically changed the way campaigns are run and how citizens interact with their elected officials and politics. We saw the power of social media and the fake news therein in the American presidential elections and in the Brexit vote. Social media have been used by political parties as both a tool of empowerment and oppression. But the latter, that is oppression, has tended to trump the former. From Bolsonaro's WhatsApp campaigns to influence voters in Brazil to the Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte's use of Facebook and troll armies, we have seen the rise and expansion of social media and its many tools to derail democracy. Indian elections, the biggest democratic spectacle in the world with about 900 million eligible voters, are a fertile ground, therefore, for the explosion of social media. We saw it happen in 2014, and we're seeing it again, deeper and grander, in 2019. Facebook's announcement last week that it had taken down hundreds of pages linked to the Congress and the BJP has cast the spotlight yet again on the onslaught of disinformation permeating what has become the primary battleground in the world's largest general election. Major international news outlets have already dubbed this the WhatsApp election. The rise in 4G connectivity, the explosion in smartphone ownership, and the expansion of internet across the country have made communicating with the electorate at an intimate level far easier. But with it have also come the perils of such communication, fake news, and unchecked propaganda. One post that went viral on social media had BJP head Amit Shah saying, and I quote, "We agree that for the election, we need a war," unquote. That post, intended to showcase the BJP as a warmongering party, was seen by 2.5 million viewers and shared several thousand times before being taken down. It was proven to be a fake. Another post, which went viral on WhatsApp, intended to showcase the Congress as soft on militancy and claimed that a party leader had promised money to free terrorists and stone pelters. That was also proven to be false. But by the time the truth catches up limping and gasping, the lie would have circled the earth many times over. How social media and messaging platforms affect the choice India makes this summer is the subject of this edition of Decoding 2019 with me, Rakesh Sharma, right here on Money Control. We saw a hint of things to come in 2014. Bypassing the unspoken media embargo that had been placed on him by conventional media houses, thanks to his alleged involvement in the Gujarat riots of 2002, then Prime Ministerial candidate Narendra Modi, with the marketing genius of advertising heavyweights such as Madison World, McCann Group, Ogilvy and Mather, and a corpus of $100 million, spoke directly to millions of voters through social media. Brand Modi was aired into homes and minds not through traditional media, but through social media, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter. Traditional media followed soon after, but the primacy of social media in that campaign should give us an indication of just how strong this medium has become. After coming to power, the affiliation of the BJP with social media did not end. If anything, it grew. The IT cell and its supporting sites labeled anyone who had anything uncomplimentary to say about the policies of the party anti-national or secular or libtard or prostitute and other such colourful terms. Mimetic warfare, that is warfare by memes, became the norm in Indian polity. Hashtags became the weaponry. It was all political theatre played out on the soundstage of social media. If in the process blood was shed, you could be certain it was not fake, even if the news was. The Indian National Congress is no stranger to these tactics either. Even though it was a Johnny-come-lately in the war waged on social media, the arrows in its quiver were shaped much the same. Memes, hashtags, and their own troll army used humor and abuse alike to berate the Prime Minister and his supporters, to say nothing, of course, of the attempts at peddling its own Janardhan Tanik Derse brand of soft Hindutva. Neither big party comes out of this clean. Of course, in the unending cycle of punch counter punch and propaganda counter propaganda, both parties and their alliances are responsible for the negativity that permeates any discourse, and both parties are responsible for the normalization of hate speech online. But the adoption of the same strategies by both the factions should tell you one thing: the power of the platform they're deploying these strategies on. On the one hand, the prevalence of social media and politics has made elected officials and candidates for public office more accountable and accessible to voters. But on the other hand, the ability to publish content and broadcast it to millions of people instantaneously allows campaigns to carefully manage their candidates' images, real or fake, based on rich sets of analytics in real time and at almost no cost. The piece on ThoughtCo went on to say, and I quote, "Social media tools including Facebook, Twitter and YouTube allow politicians to speak directly to voters without spending a dime. Using those social media allows politicians to circumvent the traditional method of reaching voters through paid advertising or earned media. It has become fairly common for political campaigns to produce commercials and publish them for free on YouTube instead of or in addition to paying for time on television or the radio. Oftentimes, journalists covering campaigns will write about those YouTube ads, especially broadcasting their message to a wider audience at no cost to the politicians. Twitter and Facebook have become instrumental in organizing campaigns. They allow like-minded voters and activists to easily share news and information such as campaign events with each other. That's what the share function on Facebook and retweet feature of Twitter are for." Unquote. Now, tools like hashtags are used by political parties for multiple purposes: to label rivals with disparaging monikers. When it comes to American politics, Lion Ted, Pocahontas, Low Energy Jeb, Crooked Hillary all come to mind. And when it comes to India, we have Chowkidar, Chowkidar Bhi Chor, Pappu, etc. To reiterate a point they want ingrained in the minds of citizens is what hashtag weaponry is all about. Nobody has used Twitter more extensively, of course, than the American president, Donald Trump, who has often taken on other countries, leaders, journalists, late-night comedy shows, actors, and even global warming to establish a connection with his base and to show his followers that he's his own man and will peddle his own ignorance with complete arrogance because he can do it just the way they expect him to without any conventional media and journalism houses in between nitpicking about journalistic standards. On social media, he simply doesn't have that problem. They have, after all, until recently claimed they're merely content aggregators and not curators. They claimed they did not have editorial responsibility. As the piece went on to note, Donald Trump used Twitter heavily in his 2016 presidential campaign and with his signature stable genius style, using his very best words, and I quote, I'm so tempted to do his voice, but I won't. "I like it because I can get also my point of view out there, and my point of view is very important to a lot of people that are looking at me." Best words from a stable genius.
The Deep Dive podcast series, Decoding 2019. The role of social media in the elections.
Social media offer unlimited freedom to dispense messaging convenient to political parties, and they don't do so randomly. As the ThoughtCo piece went on to say, political campaigns can tap into a wealth of information or analytics about the people who are following them on social media and customize their messages based on selected demographics. In other words, a campaign may find one message appropriate for voters under 30 years old will not be as effective with someone over 60 years of age, unquote. As a reporter on Time magazine went on to note, there are other proxies that a lot of political parties use in order to slot you into a certain demographic. Electricity bills, for example, indicate that if you have a higher electric bill, it might mean that you have an air conditioner and that you're slightly affluent. If you're a Hindu voter, you get sent targeted messages about Muslims taking over the country. If you're a Muslim voter, then there are messages that are tailored according to what you fear the most. So what you consume on social media is methodically cooked and seasoned just for you. But social media can also serve many purposes. It's not just an effective tool for candidates backed by an endless stream of money, but also those without financial backing, especially candidates who want to involve their voting base in the campaigning process through crowdfunding, as was the case with Kanhaiya Kumar recently, whose site was incidentally hacked, even though it had raised a considerable amount of money. What social media intervention does most effectively and frighteningly is to take focus away from reality to perception, and to create a glut of multiple colliding viewpoints where it is hard to sift the truth from propaganda. On an earlier podcast, we had spoken about how fake news and political intent are often interlinked. Take, for example, the lynchings in India triggered by WhatsApp forwards, or for that matter, the spurious messaging which resulted in a pizzeria shooting in the US. This was, of course, the result of Pizzagate, where it was alleged on some dark corners of the web that Hillary Clinton ran a pedophilia ring from the basement of a pizzeria in Washington, D.C. Then there was, of course, the smearing of gun violence victims as crisis actors. All of these these things obviously underscore the fact that fake news doesn't arise in vacuum. It is more often than not, if not always, politically intertwined. The vitriol directed towards journalists in India like Rana Ayub and the murder attempt made against student leader Umar Khalid, labeled as an anti-national, shows disturbing trends that need to be studied closely. In the United States, we saw one agitated citizen who had stockpiled weapons and ammunition, hoping to gun down a whole bunch of senators, journalists and newscasters based on what the relentless fake news machinery had fed him. So what social media can do is amplify marginal voices and make it seem like that is the truth, and from which it becomes very hard to distinguish what the truth is. As the ThoughtCo piece went on to note, direct access to voters also has its downside. Handlers and public relations professionals often manage a candidate's image. Many campaigns hire staffers to monitor their social media channels for a negative response and scrub anything that is unflattering. But such a bunker-like mentality can make a campaign appear defensive and closed off from the public. So while there are some positive points to the usage of social media in politics, the several negatives associated do make you want to take a step back and see what can be done better. Now, turning to India, the Facebook family's hold on Indian eyeballs is quite astonishing. In India, the usage of these platforms cannot be overemphasized. The Facebook family of platforms, that is Facebook, WhatsApp and Instagram, accounts for 95% of social or communication app usage in the country. Sangeeta Mohapatra, visiting fellow Institute of Asian Studies, German Institute of Global and Area Studies in Hamburg, who closely watches social media trends and politics, said in a piece, and I quote, "If one reads Statista figures along with that of Hootsuite, one finds that around 97% of smartphone owners in India use mobile apps, out of which 96% use WhatsApp." Unquote. Facebook and Twitter have taken several steps to make sure their platforms are not abused. WhatsApp is apparently using artificial intelligence to detect and ban accounts that spread problematic content, as they call it, while Facebook is labeling political advertisements and partnering with Indian fact-checkers. We also mentioned earlier that hundreds of pages have been taken down by Facebook. Twitter has announced initiatives to crack down on bad faith actors and is working closely with political parties and election authorities to ensure its platform isn't compromised during the poll. Colin Crowell, Twitter's global public policy head, said in a statement in February, and I quote, "We deeply respect the integrity of the election process and are committed to providing a service that fosters and facilitates free and open democratic debate," unquote, adding that the Indian elections were a top priority for the company. Social media etiquette and responsibility were also stressed upon by the Chief Election Commissioner Sunil Arora while releasing the schedule for the elections when the model code of conduct kicked in. Parties will also be required to get political ads on social media pre-approved by the Election Commission and declare how much they have spent on social media advertising. Candidates have also been required to share details of their social media accounts with election authorities. Sunil Arora said, and I quote, "Facebook, Twitter, Google and YouTube have committed in writing to ensure that any political advertisement published on their platforms will be certified," unquote. We already spoke about this on another podcast about how Twitter and YouTube and Facebook have been dealing with the elections and what are the measures they have enforced. So I do encourage you to take a listen to that podcast. As for fake news on WhatsApp, especially following the lynchings and now continuing into the elections, labels on forwarded messages and an awareness campaign on radio, TV and print media have been instituted. The messaging platform also limited to 5 the number of chats a single message can be forwarded to. But each WhatsApp group can have up to 256 people, meaning a message can still reach, technically, 1,280 people at the touch of a button. As Time magazine went on to report, and I quote, "Prime Minister Narendra Modi's ruling Bharatiya Janata Party has drawn up plans to have 3 WhatsApp groups for each of India's 9,27,533 polling booths, according to reports. With each group containing a maximum of 256 members, the number of group chats could theoretically reach more than 700 million people out of India's population of 1.3 billion, unquote. Amit Malviya, head of the BJP IT cell, has gone on record to say that the upcoming elections will be fought on the mobile phone. In a way, you could say they would be WhatsApp elections," unquote. A taste of that was seen in the Karnataka assembly elections when the BJP alone created as many as 23 to 25,000 WhatsApp groups. WhatsApp is a particularly useful tool, unlike carpet campaigning using flyers, etc., because the message forwarded to you on your phone is usually by a person you know. This ecosystem strategy, as it's called, is one that helps improve legitimacy and build scale. It's like receiving recommendations from one of the Kardashian sisters, if you want a reality television example. When they're hawking products to you, they've created this illusion that you're following their lives, you know, because they're also talking about the weather and the fact that they feel fat on that day. So when they tell you about a certain product, you feel like you're listening to that piece of advice from a friend and not necessarily as someone who's receiving hundreds of thousands of dollars for hawking that particular product. So when you receive a message on your phone from somebody you know, it helps improve legitimacy and, of course, build scale. So if you believe what this person is saying, it is also more likely that you will forward this to other people you know. Now, if each of the 29 states were to have 15,000 WhatsApp groups, the catchment population would be about 110 million citizens. Now, as the Economic Times went on to note, just over 170 million votes helped deliver the Lok Sabha to the BJP in 2014. So these WhatsApp groups are important, and the BJP, better than any other party, knows this. But misinformation there, as we've discussed, is rampant. And WhatsApp being encrypted, checking for misinformation is that much harder. Take one forward, for example, which read, "Wherever you look nowadays, you will see only Muslim men and women." It went on to say, 700 million Hindus, 650 million Muslims. That is, of course, patently false. In actual fact, 80% of Indians, approximately 1.1 billion, are Hindu, compared to 14%, that is approximately 188 million, are Muslim, according to the recent census of 2011. So, whatever you see in WhatsApp is not always the truth. Whoa, what a revelation. You know this already. But the point I'm trying to make is during election season, the frequency with which you receive fake news is that much higher. It's almost logarithmic, the amount of fake news that gets forwarded onto your phone every day. So my only suggestion is whatever you read on WhatsApp or Facebook, do not take it at face value. India saw an unprecedented use of social media in the 2014 elections, and in the years that followed, it prompted a well-known journalist to coin the word WhatsApp University, which has avidly promoted news of fake awards, fake images passing off as glittering Indian cities, foreign buildings awash in Indian colours, but most disturbingly, doctored videos and images to spread communal unrest. This has created a slew of fact-checking websites, but it is also easy to see the harm such unverified but compelling content can unleash. Studies have come up with mind-boggling numbers while indicating who spends how much on social media political posturing, and it is clear the focus has shifted from manifestos and report cards of governments in power to perception and image building. As the piece on ThoughtCo went on to say, and I quote, "The value of social media is in its immediacy. Politicians and campaigns do absolutely nothing without first knowing how their policy statements or moves will play among the electorate. And Twitter and Facebook both allow them to instantaneously gauge how the public is responding to an issue or controversy. Politicians can then adjust their campaigns accordingly in real time without the use of high-priced consultants or expensive polling. On the one hand, social media tools allow citizens to easily join together to petition the government and their elected officials, leveraging their numbers against the influence of powerful lobbyists and moneyed special interests. But on the other, lobbyists and special interest cliques still have the upper hand. This is, of course, the American context, but the writer, who is American, hopes that the day will come when the power of social media allows like-minded citizens to join together in ways that'll be just as powerful as those trying to influence them." A 2017 piece on Digital Vidya by Vikrant Patil posted the findings of a study on social media and politics and remarked how the success of BJP's online campaign in 2014 Lok Sabha elections brought about the biggest change in Indian politics, with even regional parties understanding the power of social media. These elections also shifted the focus of parties from rural issues to urban voters because of their familiarity with social media and their ease of connectivity. For sure, parties still spend large sums of money on posters and cutouts and flyers and graffiti and rallies, etc. But social media is now an indispensable campaigning tool. If it is used judiciously is, of course, the question we're discussing. The role of social media has come under the scanner since Donald Trump's election, especially as far as Facebook is concerned. And in previous podcasts, we have discussed and focused on how Mark Zuckerberg has had to answer questions about the accountability of social media amid rumors of Russian bots manipulating the US elections and incendiary content that has grown unmonitored under his watch. The live streaming of a mosque attack in Christchurch, New Zealand, has shown that if unchecked, social media can be weaponized to do more harm than good. The American election was a perfect example of how polarization popularity can be created through spreading rumors about rivals, creating confusion, and diluting the credibility of far more seasoned political rivals. Facebook announced in March that it finally intends to ban content that glorifies white nationalism and separatism. The company said in a statement, and I quote, "It is clear that these concepts are deeply linked to organized hate groups and have no place on our services," unquote. This news came after Facebook's extensive discussions with civil society groups and race relations experts over the last 3 months. Recently, news broke that Facebook has deleted 712 accounts and 390 pages in India and Pakistan for inauthentic behavior. Many of these pages and accounts were linked to India's opposition party, that is the Congress, days before a national election, and others were related to Pakistan's military. This came in the wake of increasing vigilance on part of social media giants after criticism that they've allowed their platforms to be abused for political purposes or to spread misinformation. This happened, as some news reports pointed out, in an environment where all parties, including the ruling party and the Prime Minister himself and many other leaders, continue to use Facebook to send political messages to millions, not to mention the countless unverified pages that run their own toxic campaigns. Facebook said it had taken down 549 accounts and 138 pages linked to the Congress for coordinated inauthentic behavior. In a tweet, though, Congress said that none of its official pages or those run by its verified volunteers had been taken down. The party awaits a response from Facebook to provide a list of all pages and accounts which were removed, it went on to say. While quoting a Facebook statement in this regard, Reuters, however, reported the bit that did not get much airtime in virulent news channels. The fact that Facebook also removed 15 accounts linked to an IT company which, among other things, issued posts on the BJP and alleged misconduct of political opponents, including Congress. Reuters said that the digital forensic research lab at think tank Atlantic Council, which partnered with Facebook for the review, said the accounts linked to Congress pushed satirical posts, while pro-BJP pages carried vitriolic posts against opposition leaders. The fact that partisans on both sides resorted to such tactics is a troubling feature. The Reuters report, written by Aditya Kalra and Saad Saeed, mentioned the removal of pages connected to Indian IT firm SilverTouch, thought to be associated with a mobile app promoted by Modi's BJP. Quoting from that piece, after BJP's IT head Amit Malviya told Reuters both the party and the app had nothing to do with SilverTouch, Facebook, in a new statement, said it had, quote, "seen no evidence to date of SilverTouch being associated with the Namo app on our platform," referring, of course, to the Narendra Modi app, unquote. A Quartz India report written by Arya Thakur, however, says that there is more to Facebook's purge of Indian political pages than meets the eye. Quoting from that piece on Quartz, the social media site's announcement that it had taken down Indian accounts engaged in coordinated inauthentic behavior and the ensuing media coverage suggested that the development had a top-sided effect on the Indian National Congress. After all, of the over 700 political pages and accounts that Facebook said it had removed, 687 were linked to the main opposition party, while only 15 were associated with the Prime Minister Narendra Modi's BJP. Reports, though, say that the number of BJP-linked pages taken down could be well over 200, even if not specified directly in Facebook's blog post. Nevertheless, a look beyond the mere number of pages that were affected shows that the removals have been far more damaging for the BJP. For starters, the 15 pro-BJP pages removed were all linked to SilverTouch, an Ahmedabad-based IT firm that has reportedly developed Modi's official app, besides working on several government projects. While Facebook named only one page in this group, that is the India Eye, it alone had over 2.5 million followers and was well established, including in every user's default news feed in the Namo app. The piece cites Ben Nimmo, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Digital Forensic Research Lab, that is DFR Lab, who said, and I quote, "The pro-BJP campaign was big and long-lasting. It picked up over 2 million followers and managed to stay below the radar for years. The Congress campaign that was removed was much smaller and its pages didn't have so much impact individually. It looks like they were trying to build up impact by running lots of micro-pages rather than one big one," unquote. The piece further says that Twitter chatter indicates that the India Eye isn't the only pro-BJP page to have been removed. Prateek Sinha, co-founder of the fact-checking website Alt News, tweeted a list of screenshots of different individuals who manage pro-right-wing Facebook pages claiming they had been unpublished. Quoting from that piece, "many right-wing accounts are furious that their Facebook pages or pages of people they know that have been unpublished or deleted. Yet, Facebook press release talks about exactly one right-wing page, the India Eye. Why so? Some of these pages are quite notable, including the one belonging to My Nation, which is a right-wing digital publication of a BJP parliamentarian. Abhijit Iyer Mitra, a right-wing defense analyst, claimed hundreds of right-wing accounts had been deleted by Facebook. Other major right-wing influencers initially tweeted along these lines, only to later delete their comments. Unquote. Nimmo went on to add further, and I quote, "The big difference was that the International Congress operation could afford to lose some of its pages without putting a big dent in its overall operation. The takedown of the pro-BJP pages will have much more impact on the overall operation because their followings was so much bigger. The India Eye alone had 2.5 million followers." How game-changing social media content has been can be gauged from a piece published by The Verge, which cites a September 2018 BuzzFeed news feature, which showed how in the Philippines, much of the extreme political rhetoric on Facebook props up Philippine President Duterte's authoritarian reign, and how from the very beginning of Duterte's presidential campaign, Facebook was an essential tool for Duterte fans to freely spread coordinated messages on Facebook, especially because, thanks to deals that the company struck with local carriers, Facebook is free to use in the Philippines for anyone who has a smartphone, much like it is in India. The Verge article also points out that Trump spent $3.6 million on Facebook ads from the 30th of December to the 23rd of March this year, according to data compiled by researchers at the Online Advertising Transparency Project, an ongoing study launched last year at New York University that tracks political ad spending through Facebook's publicly available political ad archive. The point being that in authoritarian regimes, censorship and control of social media is another way of strengthening political clout, as it is in China, where People.cn, which is the digital arm of the main propaganda outlet for China's ruling party, makes a lot of money by scrubbing inconvenient content. What needs to be understood finally is how a media tool in the hands of political leaders can hamper dissent and curb democratic voices. Compare the clout of political pages flush with money to the cash-strapped journalism of slain writer Gauri Lankesh, who, as the New York Times said in a piece recently, refused to allow advertisements in her newspaper Gauri Lankesh Patrike, which she felt was necessary to ward off the corruption and outside pressure that often compromise the Indian press. Quoting from the New York Times, Lankesh Patrike ran on subscription and newsstand sales, supplemented by a book publishing sideline. But the paper's financial situation had become so dire that she had decided, for the very first time, to run ads in a forthcoming special holiday issue. Unquote. That day, of course, did not come because she was murdered. What the piece went on to say, though, is that it was her political activism and her lively social media presence that had extended her reach far beyond the paper's print run. The New York Times went on to say, and I quote, "At a time of intense vitriol against the press in India, she was a fearless, sometimes reckless critic of the right-wing Hindu nationalist BJP, which has held power in India since 2014. Her paper was a tabloid in every sense, gleefully sensational and indifferent to decorum. But the vehemence and humor of her polemics in defense of pluralism and minority rights had made her a beloved figure to an increasingly embattled opposition." Unquote. Rolo Romig, the writer of the NYT piece, went on to add, and I quote, "By the end of May, national elections will determine if Modi and the BJP are elected to another 5 years. It is likely to be the ugliest campaign season in India's history. Hostility towards journalists and opposition figures is intensifying as voting day approaches. The police last year arrested 11 opposition activists and lawyers on what appear to have been flimsy charges of instigating violence at an event in Maharashtra, that is the Bhima Koregaon protest, and in February arrested, on apparently even thinner evidence, the prominent caste scholar Anand Teltumbre. Tensions have further risen since the 14th of February when a suicide bomber killed 40 Indian soldiers in Kashmir, setting off a series of skirmishes with Pakistan that are likely to politically benefit the BJP." Unquote. Now, if you think the New York Times and me are taking shots only at the BJP, you could not be more wrong, as the piece does not absolve the Congress party either, and points out how, despite a generally secular politics and social democratic demeanor, it has undoubtedly been guilty at times of suppressing the press and of condoning the mass slaughter of religious minorities. We can, of course, add the crackdown on the press during the emergency to that list. But perhaps it is the age of social media that has made it easy for hate rhetoric to spread faster than it ever has. As the piece points out, in this rhetoric, being Indian is equated with being Hindu, and religious minorities are spoken of as if they were foreigners. Critics are branded as anti-national, advocates of a secular Indian state, which the Indian institution calls for in its very first sentence, are called, well, seculars. What Gauri Lankesh's demise has established, though, is that in the end, the accountability to sift fact from fiction justice from injustice, truth from accountability does not just lie with the press, media platforms, politicians, or social media entities. It lies with us, the citizens, who must, in the end, choose their version of India through their votes, because their volition, finally, is the most important and most powerful democratic tool, one that can set the tone for how democracy fares in the years to come. And much of how we decide and much of what we are told we need have come thanks to little apps on our smartphones. How smart a choice that leads people to make is, of course, anyone's guess. And we will keep you updated.
The Deep Dive podcast series, Decoding 2019. The role of social media in the elections.
Do let us know your comments and criticisms on mcpodcast@nw18.com. Until the next time you hear from me, this is me, Rakesh Sharma, on behalf of the Money Control Podcast Desk, saying thank you for joining us and do stay with us on moneycontrol.com to be a smart listener and an even smarter investor.
This has been a Digging Deeper podcast, and you have been listening to Money Control.